Morning. So let's start by sitting for 2 or 3 minutes. And sometimes it's good to start by just noticing our bodily sensations. Just noticing. Different parts of our body. Softnesses, hardnesses, tensions. Just being with them. Just coming back to any sensations in our body that are predominant. Just being with them. And then from there, moving into our breath. Watching our breath. Noticing our breath come in and go out. Come in and go out. Just gently and kindly bringing our mind back to our breath each time it wanders out. If it helps to count our breath, that's fine. It helps to say something like deep on the in-breath and calm on the out-breath, that's fine. Or maybe you'd rather just surf your breath. Very good. Very good. So this morning, I want to talk about 4 yogas within the Zen path. A talk that I last gave in some form or other, I don't keep very good notes, about 5 or 6 years ago. So, as you know, Zen comes from Buddhism, Buddhism comes from India, yoga comes from India. And Patanjali was writing the Yoga Sutra in the 2nd century before the contemporary era, just when a Buddhist sitting was getting started. So it's interesting just to look at the yogas, the 4 yogas of Patanjali, and see how they're embedded in our Zen practice. All 4 of them are, to some degree or other. So I want to talk about Raja Yoga, briefly. I want to talk about Bhakti Yoga, briefly. I want to talk about Jnana, J-N-A-N-A, Yoga, briefly. And I want to talk about Karma Yoga, briefly, because those are the 4 that Patanjali emphasizes in the Yoga Sutras, and They're all part of what we do here at Zen Center. Of course, we use different words, but you know, everybody uses different words. And they fight about whose words are best, right? So Raja Yoga, the kingly yoga. Just what we were doing. Just what we were doing 2 minutes ago. We were doing the kingly yoga, Raja Yoga. Sitting up straight, breathing, being still, allowing our minds to still, noticing the thoughts, bringing them back. Called the kingly yoga by Patanjali because it's for him the primary one. And you know, we are the Zen school, which means a translation of Chan, which is a translation of D-H-A, D-H-Y-A-N-A, jhana. And in when Patanjali talks about the Raja Yoga, he says jhana, D-H-Y-N-A, is the most important aspect of sitting. And of course, this goes with Buddha's statement, do not look to me, look to the Dharma. When everybody was hanging around him, everybody was kind of glomming off it, and he was getting old. Be a light unto yourself, he said. Be a light to yourself. And then, of course, some stories say that he just decided he was going to die because people were glomming on to him too much, and they wouldn't become lights unto themselves unless he left. Believe that if you want to. You can believe anything you want to. And you probably will. You do. So, here Patanjali says, when the mind has been trained to remain fixed on a certain internal or external location, there comes to it the power of flowing in an unbroken current toward that point. And of course, our first icon in Zen is Bodhidharma. He's like our primary icon. And what is Bodhidharma doing? Well, he's sitting. He's doing Raja Yoga. That's what he's doing. He does it all day for 9 years, right? According to the myth. I guess with breaks for snacks or something. He doesn't talk about the breaks for snacks, but... So Raja Yoga, the kingly yoga, there's something dignified about just taking this posture. Just taking this posture. Not trying to do anything in particular. Just sitting in this posture. And referred to in Chinese Zen as silent illumination. And that's what Patanjali says, that through practicing Raja Yoga, you will... become illuminated. You become illuminated. You will look, you will discover the Atman, which is one with Brahma. The Atman, the still place within you. Still place that ego doesn't see, because ego is so hurried. So hurried. Not just in the 21st century, but in the second century before the contemporary era. So hurried, ego. So we discover Atman. But then, of course, Buddha said, no Atman. No Atman. Well, then we have a couple of 200 years, 300 years later, and they're talking about Buddha nature. Buddha nature sounds an awful lot like Atman to me. Quiet, still place within yourself. You wake up to it, and it's spacious and includes all life within it. Sounds exactly the same. Well, then we have to have, you know, other teachers coming along and Zen and saying, no, no Buddha nature. Because we get, you know, we reify, we get stuck. We get stuck. But anyway, very, very similar. Very, very similar. And within the Raja Yoga, there's something called Hatha Yoga. And Patanjali says, well, if you're going to do Raja Yoga, you should do some stretching. I'm colloquializing Patanjali. It's quite formal the way he lays it out, but, you know, can't help if it's me. You do some Hatha. And, of course, all the yoga around the country is Hatha yoga, which Patanjali says should be a good preparation for the kingly yoga. Good preparation, a good complement. And, you know, in our retreats here, we do... Hatha yoga now, just like Patanjali told us to before. Yeah, just like he told us to. So that's the kingly yoga. And practicing the kingly yoga daily is what Patanjali recommends, in addition to dipping into it for longer periods of time. Retreats, which we do here. So what are the, and of course, I can go on and on about each of these, but I'm not going to this morning. What are the limitations of Raja Yoga? Hakuin talked about the limitations. Hakuin said, great Zen masters, Hakuin referred to practitioners of Zazen, as it was being done then, in the Soto tradition, which is very much like Raja Yoga, as silent illumination heretics. Why did he do that? He thought, this sitting, just by itself, can be very dead. You just develop a routine, and you do it over and over again, and geez, you might as well just be planning your day, because you're planning your day anyway. You're just looking dignified. You're looking still, and everybody says, wow. So that's definitely a limitation of Raja Yoga, that it can be kind of dead sitting by itself. So the next one, the second yoga I'm going to talk about is a little bit, is Bhakti Yoga. So Bhakti Yoga. So Raja Yoga is Jiriki in Japan, self-power. Self-power school in Japanese Buddhism. And then we have Tariki, other power. And that's from, really, we find that in Bhakti Yoga, in Patanjali's discussion of Patanjali, the Yoga Sutras. And you know, Bhakti Yoga, devotional yoga, where you give yourself away, I didn't realize that was in Zen when I started. If it had been, I probably wouldn't have done Zen. If you read the books by Alan Watts and D.T. Suzuki, you don't get it. You don't think there's going to be any bowing. And there's a story which, I guess I'll tell it. There's a story about Alan Watts. Alan Watts, one of the early authors who wrote about Zen, taking some Americans to Japan to visit different temples, and he took an American to one temple, and the Roshi took the Alan and the other guy around to visit different rooms and different parts of the temple, and of course the teacher was bowing. He bowed every time he saw a figure of the Buddha, of the Bodhisattva, when he entered the Zendo. You know, he did, and the American was getting pretty frustrated, and because he thought this was Zen. What's all this bowing? And he said to him, you're bowing to all these Buddhas, all these figures. Are they Buddhas? Are they alive? He said, what is this bowing? I could just as easily spit on them. And the teacher said, remember the answer to this one? You do. The teacher said, okay, I bow as you spits. So we have a Bhakti Yoga in our tradition, big time. People who are drawn to Bhakti Yoga tend to be, and the Myers-Briggs tend to be more feeling types. Ask people, you'll find that out. That's my own personal research over the years. They're more feeling types on the Myers-Briggs. So other power, we give ourselves away. My teacher talked about his teacher having a callus on his forehead from all the bowing to the floor he'd done. And I thought, so what? But my teacher thought, oh, this is cool. So we in our devotional practice, we are giving ourselves away. And we have images of the Buddha, images of bodhisattvas, all of these that we bow to, All these, though, originated after Buddha's time. That's interesting, isn't it? Because Buddha was not into that stuff in regard to him. And we don't know if he followed the Hindu bhakti way before it had been really articulated, because there was a lot of bowing, but he sure never talked about any of that. Although you do, when you read the Pali, you see the monks bowing to him, so it's all sort of, we don't know. You know, we don't really know. Except that in India, bowing is social greeting. Social greeting. Namaste, social greeting. So also, venerable teachers, we honor the venerable teachers, the teachers of old, and all you have to do is die and you become venerable. So as soon as Suzuki died, he was a Daisho. We added him to our chant. Daisho. It didn't take long. As soon as Katagiri died, we added him to our chant. Daisho. So any teacher who dies becomes a Daisho. I'm being a little bit facetious here, but you would only do this to a teacher you respect and love. But it doesn't happen before death, it happens after death. This is, again, according to the tradition. You know, do with the tradition what you want. I'm just explaining it to you. So we do our bows here on Tuesday morning. We do the Daisho to the teachers, and we do that on Saturdays, where we recite all the ancestral names, and we give ourselves away to teacher after teacher. And we have our Founders Hall, which you guys are sitting in, which is dedicated to Dainen Katagiri Roshi, who is the founder of this temple. Because of him, we're here. But, you know, because of us, he's here too. If we hadn't been here, he wouldn't have come. You know? So it's always reciprocal. So offerings, part of our bhakti. Flowers. Boy, look at the flower arrangements around here. Every day, I look at the flowers, and they just make me feel so good. I'm actually not very much of a feeling guy in the Myers-Briggs, but when I see those flowers, oh, I feel so calm and so wonderful. Because someone puts a lot, there's a lot of beauty in it. A lot of beauty. You don't even have to sit for 1 second, and you just take in that beauty, and it kind of blesses you out if you're in the right frame of mind. Chanting. Now, Sunday morning we used to be more of have a bhakti component, but I've gotten it down so we have barely any bhakti. But we still do a little bit on Sunday morning. And Pure Land Buddhism is all about bhakti. All about bhakti. Shin Buddhism, which is the Japanese word for Pure Land Buddhism, that's the Buddhism that Katagiri, our founder, was raised in. And, you know, the main practice is homage to Amitabha Buddha. Namu Amida Butsu, Namu Amida Butsu, Namu Amida Butsu. That's the whole practice. That's the whole deal. Devoting yourself to this Buddha so that you can be reborn on this moment or after death in the heavenly paradise that he's opening up to you. And you're still within your still mind, within your giving yourself away, and you're letting go of all of your worries, just giving yourself to Namo Amida Butsu, Namo Amida Butsu. Nichiren Buddhism, the second very popular Buddhism in Japan. Myo Renge Kyo, I can't say it very well, but I once with a teacher went over and over. Myo Renge Kyo. Kyo, does anybody know it? Huh? Oh, say it. Oh, okay. Well, we're struggling with it. Anyway, Nichiren, the teacher Nichiren said, oh, you don't have to do this zazen. You know, this sitting is, you know, it's too strenuous. Just give yourself to the Lotus Sutra. The Lotus Sutra is the Bible of Buddhism. It's the whole deal. It should be our Bible. You give yourself to this Bible. And of course, it's the lotus flower, you know, it grows out of the mud. And you give yourself to that, and you too, right in the middle of the mud, become a beautiful flower. Because you devote yourself, you give yourself away to it. Of course, it becomes very sectarian too. all very sectarian, because this is the one scripture, just like in Christianity, this is the one scripture. Pilgrimages, part of bhakti, pilgrimages to Buddha's place of Buddha's birth, pilgrimages now to the place of Suzuki Roshi's birth in Japan. A lot of people going there. It seems weird to me because I knew the guy, but I mean, you know, well, I wouldn't mind going to where he was born, but you know, this is the way we do. This is what humans seem to need, this, and it seems to get us out of ourselves and help us connect with something larger. Our meal chants. Buddha was born at Lumbini, enlightened at Bodhgaya, taught at Parnassi, entered Nirvana at Kushinagara. Anybody heard that? That's what we do in all of our traditional retreats. So we're taking a pilgrimage to the place of Buddha's birth, where he got enlightened, where he taught, and where he shed his body, where he died. Finally, the Heart Sutra. We chant the Heart Sutra here 5 days a week, and it's chanted all over the world in Buddhist countries, Zen and Tibetan. And it seems like it's kind of non-devotional, because you say no, not to just about everything, but as we know, a bodhisattva depends on prajnaparamita. Well, we chant, a bodhisattva depends on prajnaparamita, and the mind is no hindrance. All Buddhas depend on prajnaparamita. And then we end with prajnaparamita, maha prajnaparamita. Well, from one sense, from the jiriki sense, prajnaparamita is the wisdom that's gone beyond all of our dualistic thinking, all of our categorizing, all of our trying to figure things out, all of our labeling, all of our insisting that this is the way. So we let go of it all. On the other hand, prajnaparamita is also the mother of all the Buddhas. So we're giving ourselves away to Kali, the Dharma man. And again, back to Hinduism, to Kali. Although prajnaparamita doesn't have the fierceness that Kali does, but aside from that. So, really, bhakti is part of this tradition. And actually, bhakti is part of all spiritual traditions. I mean, you just find it. And I originally got into Zen because I thought, oh, Zen isn't like that, doesn't do that stuff. I'm not interested in that stuff. But here I am. And you can see why it's helpful to folks, and why it's actually quite wonderful. So when I in the late 80s and early 90s, I was gone from Zen Center for six, seven years, and partly that was because for me things were becoming too ritualized here, too much emphasis on, you know, you wear it this way, this is the way Buddha did it, and you bow here and you bow this many times and do this. So I left. But you know, during the years I was gone, well, first I worked with a Lakota teacher, and the Lakota teacher had me go on hamblechas. Hamblechas, what are those? Those are times that you go up on the hill. He takes you up on a hill, and you cry for awakening. So that's a bhakti practice. You cry for awakening. You humble yourself. You go down on the ground. You give yourself up, and you cry for awakening, because it's in your heart. It's a feeling practice. So I thought, well, that's interesting. Then after I worked with Elmer for a while, I started going to these Amachi retreats, and Amachi's still up on my altar. Well, Amachi is a realized Hindu saint, and you go to her retreats, and it's all bhakti. You're sitting upright, not cross-legged, but you're chanting, and you're giving yourself away, and you're humbling yourself and you're opening yourself to her vibes in particular, but which are the vibes of universal stillness. Universal stillness, and you feel those, and it's very wonderful, very wonderful. So, and it was actually when I was at an Amici retreat, and I had been doing this for a whole. You do it late into the night. And she hugs everybody. She's the hugging saint. So she hugs everybody. If there are 500 people there, she'll hug her 500 people. And she really hugs you, too. I mean, she doesn't just, try to rush through the line. And so sometimes it'd go on till 2 a.m., 3 a.m., because there'd be 800 people. She travels around the world. She's still doing this. I haven't been there in years, but hugging people. Anyway, one of the last ones I went to, after doing all this bowing and chanting, well, then I went back to my room and I sat up in the bed, in my bed, on a cushion in zazen, because zazen is still my thing. But my mind was still so still after having done that with her that I felt really good. And actually, I saw myself coming back to zazen. So then I came back to zazen. That's my story. So what are the limitations of bhakti? Well, there are limitations. One is that this sense of sacrifice to fulfill your ego's needs. It alleviates guilt. You get good vibes. You feel like you're a good person. People think, oh, how spiritual you are. But, you know, that can be a real trap. And we know this. Those of you who were raised in Catholic-type traditions know this. Or similar traditions. And then also, bhakti centers on unequal relationships too much. Unequal relationships. There's one divine person or being, one person who is enlightened, one deity, one whatever. Got to be careful of that, don't you think? Careful of that. Perfect teacher, you know. We always in our ordination ceremonies, we have the things that we repeat, and also there's a phrase in there, the perfect teacher, and I've taken perfect out of all of that because it gives us an illusion that I don't think is very healthy. Complete teacher, maybe complete, authentic, real. Alive, okay? Perfect. If you want to say perfect, that's okay. So also from the Bodhidharma's point of view, or Wei Neng's point of view, or even Wang Po's point of view, these spiritual beings, these bodhisattvas, these Buddhas, these Suzukis, these Katagiris, they're all just projections. If the ego is a fiction, then aren't these other things fictions too? If there's a fictional self inside, we think, the self inside is just fiction, but these are all real. Well, come on. Come on. Then we have our little religion that we are ready to fight for, and we do fight for. And that's not, doesn't help human beings very much, does it? I don't think so. So that's the second one. The third one is jnana, J-N-A-N-A. The reason I'm pronouncing these is that jnana is D-H-Y-A-N-A, and it sounds almost like jnana, J-N-A-N-A, but they're not. Okay? Jnana is the neti-neti tradition. In Patanjali, it talks quite a bit about it. Not this, not this. Not this, not this. Who am I? It's the who am I tradition. I'm not. If we go through the skangas, through the aggregates, I'm not my body. I'm not my body. I'm not my sensations. I'm not my perceptions. I'm not my impulses. I'm not my desires. It sure seems like I'm my thoughts and emotions, though. But I'm not. I'm not. So who am I? Who am I? Who are we really? We're really the Buddha nature? What's that? What is the Buddha nature? Is there something there? Or is nothing? So this deeply going into this question of who and what you are in your meditation is a very noble tradition going back to before Patanjali. Neti neti, I'm not this, not that. This jnana practice appeals more to people who are thinking types than the Myers-Briggs. Again, this is my informal survey over the years. I will publish my data soon. Deep questioning. Yasutani Roshi, whom some of you know, have read about and know, whom I practiced with when I was young, he was raised in Raja Yoga. He was a Soto Zen priest in Raja Yoga, just sitting in the Soto Zen kind of way, just sitting. But it wasn't until he was, we'd have to go back and look, I think something like 50 years old, that he met a teacher who said, well, the sitting is fine, but really, have you looked into who you are? Have you really looked into that? And he realized that he'd just been sort of doing this dead sitting for all these years as part of the Soto way. You just get up and you sit in the morning, and like your Katagiri said, you brush your teeth, you sit. But if you do it in a dead way, just as a habit, then you can't penetrate to the below all of this coagulated confusion. But if you ask, who, what, you have a chance to go right through it to the stillness that's always here. The dynamic stillness that's always here. Jnana yoga, deep questioning. And of course, the koans come out of that. Norman Fisher was here last weekend, and he and I were talking about that, and he was talking about that with the group, that all the koans really come out of the original who am I? Which is really Buddha's question on his quest for those supposedly 8 years. And then we have teachers in the 20th century like Ramana Maharshi, who didn't do any Raja Yoga to speak of, didn't do any bhakti, but just one day he sat down and he began to really wonder who he was. How many of you have read about Ramana Maharshi? He really wondered. So he began to, that was all he cared about. He didn't care about eating. He didn't care about sleeping. He just knew that he wasn't all these thoughts and all this confusion. So he asked and asked and asked. And he became very focused, very one-pointed. And within 3 days, with nothing other than just asking, who am I? He broke open into huge awareness of his non-separation with all life. So what are the limitations of jnana? Well, it's not so good for feeling types, meaning it's a little bit hard for feeling types. They don't. Now, I'm generalizing, so don't. I mean, I'm just playing with the Myers-Briggs. It's just another. You don't get too. Don't believe it too much. It requires a lot of energetic probing without any relief. No relief. No rituals depend on. I mean, look at all the rituals in bhakti that you get to depend on. No rituals. You don't get to, you don't do calm sitting. You just ask. Of course, the thing about jnana is that if you're doing sincere zazen, this question of who am I is probably going to come up in some form or other. You begin to doubt yourself. You doubt your sitting. Well, then you go into that. Wow, what is this doubt? Who's doubting? What's going on here? What's this doubt about? And that is quite wonderful. Can be quite wonderful. I mean, it doesn't feel wonderful at the time, but if you come see me, I'll get excited about it. Really. Because it's a scent, it's a sign that you're really going inside. That you're really beginning to cut through all of your superfluous baggage. So the last one is karma yoga. Karma yoga. Wholehearted activity in the world. From the Bhagavad Gita, which is also second century before the contemporary era. So Brahma's really telling Arjuna how to do karma yoga. That's the essence of the Bhagavad Gita. Although it's all about war, but we won't get into that right now. That's really what the teaching is. Perform your service, he says to, and again I'm paraphrasing, to Arjuna, so wholeheartedly that the fruit is in the activity itself. That the fruit is irrelevant, because in the wholehearted doing it, of performing the service, there's the fruit. And of course, in Zen, we have Baijiang. A day without work is a day without eating. But that's not some Puritan thing. That's because work, service to the community, supporting people, supporting the earth, it's essential to Zen practice. So the story that I tell about Suzuki, my teacher, my first teacher, in when he wanted to do a meditation group in my hometown of Palo Alto. And I'm trying to remember how this goes, but he's come down a couple of times, and we have it in this graduate student's house, and the house is kind of messy. And so after we sit, he rolls up his sleeves on his sleeves and his kind of his work blouse, and we clean the house. And you know, we do that every time for two or three times. And we don't do it because he's a Puritan, but because that's part of our practice. We sit and we work. We work and we sit. And they're not two. In both times, we're giving ourselves to the immediate experience, and we're focusing on just being present with the activity. So but I have to go to class in the morning. I'm in college. So I finally say to him, well, you know, we're in college. We have to go to class. So can't we just limit this to maybe 2 minutes of work? And he said, no. He said, maybe we should sit earlier. Well, we're already starting at 5:45 in the morning. God, we're college students. I'm starting by staying up all night. Because, you know, you may not remember those biorhythms when you were young. So, that karma yoga, very important in Zen. Very important in Zen. So I'd like to give a shout out to Mark Turbach. Is he here?
He's right here.
Hi, and Dave Walter. Is Dave here? Well, they're the karma yogis here. I mean, Mark has done an incredible job of getting people organized and focused to do work around here, and things are looking beautiful. And Dave too, go out in the backyard. Wow, that's our practice just as much as our zazen is. And one of my favorite karma yogis, as those of you know who've heard me talk before, is Ram Dass. Ram Dass. Ram Dass said that his goal was to be like Gandhi, who said, my life is my message. And so Ram Dass said here, if I can be like Gandhi with that message, that makes my whole incarnation a service. There will always be immense suffering. What I can do is offer my kindness as a karma yogi, knowing that I'm not going to solve anything. You're not going to solve anything. If you separate the fruits from the actions, you'll be in despair. But if you just give yourself to the to it, you actually will help. You will help just by whatever you do. So what are the limitations of karma, of karma yoga? Well, becoming service workaholics. Yes, becoming service workaholics, neglecting our own needs, our family's needs, our own number one. Number two, feeling superior. We're the missionaries. We're going to serve you heathens. We're the Buddhist missionaries. We're gonna serve you Christian heathens. You guys are totally out of it, you know. We'll serve you, and then you'll get it. You'll get it, right? If folks being helped sense that they're being judged in any way, it only increases their pain too, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. So then when I came back to Zen Center and became the guiding teacher here 12 or 13 years ago, I thought about these different strands of our tradition and what I kind of wanted to try to emphasize. And it seemed important to me to primarily focus on Zazen, on Raja Yoga, because that's what Zen is, primarily. But then to add to do some of this other stuff too. So, but originally when I came back, we didn't have contemporary retreats, and our Sundays were quite a bit more ritualized. But I wanted to come back to the simplicity of Zazen and do some contemporary retreats where we just do Zazen, we just do Raja Yoga, and then of course we do some Karma Yoga, some work. And we can always do jnana. You can always look in at any time. And then have some traditional retreats which really combine the bhakti and the raja. And that's what we've been doing for a few years. And it's been working, I think, quite well. So on the one hand, we could say that from a raja yoga point of view, spiritual beings, as I said, are all just fictions, and rituals reinforce this fiction. On the other hand, Tariki and Jiriki are really, this is Jiriki and this is Tariki, they're the same. Because if we completely give ourselves away, we discover that there's no separate self to give away. Just as when we sit still in self-power, we let go of the fictional self, and we're just here in the world. So they're not really two. They're two vehicles to understand just this. To experience just this. Or to live just this. So that's basically what I want to talk about this morning. And there's a little time for questions or comments. Or stories or jokes.
I have a question.
Okay.
My question is about Raja.
Uh-huh.
Yoga. How is it really different from Zen? I wonder, in Zen meditation, I feel I have just as good a chance to sit there wasting my time. I am just not able to focus on the moment.
Yes, both of them have that drawback, both Raja Yoga and Zen, and Zen sitting. But if you combine them, that's why we combine them. We do Karma Yoga when you eat, you just eat. When you walk, you just walk. When you rake the yard, you just rake the yard. We do just sitting, and then we also do asking. So if the just sitting isn't working, you do the asking. And of course, the Raja Yoga has the same two components that the Zen meditation I teach has, both Shikantaza and then using your breath or using a phrase to evoke stillness. But that's right, lots of times it doesn't work. So then all that means is introduce the other yogas. Work with some karma yoga. Work with some jnana yoga. And if you can do bhakti, do some bhakti. Make beautiful flower arrangements, giving yourself completely to that flower arrangement. Okay? Other folks?
So, there, it's interesting because there's all of these intersect with each other in places. There's
yeah.
A Venn diagram, kind of.
Yes, that's right. Yes, that's
and
right.
Like you're not, you know, cooking. There's sort of ritual aspect to it that has this very sort of
that's right.
yourself to it, but it's also work practice. But it's also, so, you know, it's like there's this Venn diagram. Of these
that's
things.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. And this is just one way of talking about it. But it just interests. It's interesting that it started with these four specific yogas. And that we really find them all embedded in our Zen practice to one degree or another, and of course different teachers emphasize different parts of them. So. Anything else?
I have a question, Tim.
Sure.
So yoga and meditation are becoming very mainstream mm-hmm. in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people approach both, and certainly myself included at times, for really practical benefits of physical fitness or
uh-huh.
stress relief or relaxation. I was wondering if you could speak to what you feel some of the positives are for that very practical approach to meditation. What are some of the pitfalls?
Well, I think the all the hatha yoga that's being done in this country now is really cool. I mean, it's almost like on every street corner. I mean, it's amazing how little by little. And usually those different yoga, they end with like a minute of meditation or 2 minutes of meditation. So I can only, I think that's wonderful. That's wonderful. I do see that as a little bit of a preamble. And I hope that people will go beyond the preamble. Because Patanjali thought of it as a preamble to earnest sitting. Now, what about the kind of so that's the hatha yoga part, and then the meditation, Jon Kabat-Zinn style meditation, mindfulness meditation. Boy, I'm reading the New York Times is talking about mindfulness meditation now, all over the place. It's like mindfulness has almost become a cliche.
Be careful, watch it.
Yeah. What?
Watch it with.
Yeah.
That's my book.
Don't
be dissing my book.
Oh. Okay. Oh, I see what you're saying. I see. It's almost become a cliche. So the problem with cliches is that we don't go very deep often. We just become, it becomes like, you know, oh, you've discovered prayer, and then everybody pray. After a while, prayer doesn't have any meaning anymore. So I think it's wonderful, but It should be a preamble to the possibility of doing a practice, a regular practice, which has some discipline in which you really return to a stillness that you always have, and you always will have. That's timeless, and yet no big deal. How's that, Mark?
Awesome.
Oh boy. Yeah.
A few weeks ago, I was upstairs in the intern class, and someone asked, "What's the difference between Zen and meditation and Indian or Hindu meditation?"
Uh-huh.
And I started thinking about that and observing and taking an Iyengar yoga.
Uh-huh. Hatha.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I have noticed a really big difference.
Okay, let's tell us about it.
Well, at the end of the class, when we're doing some meditation for a while, the focus is on to draw the tongue oh. way back in the throat and the eyes way up here.
I see. Okay.
Which seems very different from the pen where you are staying, there is a focus. You know, you aren't like just withdrawing, like, you know, drawing all your senses up into your inner body, but that you're remaining in a sense in the...
Well, that's right. That's good. So there are two ways of talking about that. The first is that in the preparatory hatha yogas, which are part of Patanjali, he's just talking about those as preparatory ways of settling down so you can do the Raja Yoga posture and the Raja Yoga sitting. That's one way of talking about it. The second is that Buddhists generally feel that, and Hindus withdrew a little bit too much. That was a little too much with emphasis on boundarylessness and withdrawing from life as it is right here. And so the reason we have for keeping the eyes half open is partly that when you close your eyes or you're more inwardly focused and possibly more inwardly fixated when you want to be in the world as it is. So those are two different sort of takes on this. Anything else?
Hey, I just want to relate to what we were talking about.
Okay.
My nephew has a list of the items to do before he goes to bed in his room.
Uh-huh.
Brush teeth, potty, PJs, dirty clothes in the laundry, pick up a room, read in bed, and number 7 is meditate.
Oh, yeah. So what do you think of that?
It's awesome. Uh-huh.
Good. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.